But I just gotta say, I was not expecting to learn that James Monroe is just an absolute badass. Like, he's just like a war veteran. I mean, I don't know. You get shot in a severed artery in 1775 after your rich uncle sends you to an elite school that you could have just chilled out the entire time, but you're like, nah.
Welcome to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, the macaroni to Eric Mason's ethically produced cheese, who also happens to be the chief economist of Quincy, Massachusetts, when he's not here regaling us with incredulous facts about our founding fathers. This week, we are on to James Monroe, and after Mr. Madison's wild ride, I don't really know what to expect anymore, other than the fact that one singular word in this episode will be mispronounced. And super fan status will go to the person that is first to post it in the comments. And no, it will not be Desiree this time.
I have no idea. I'm excited about that. That was not planned.
No, I'm just guessing there's going to be at least one word that we mispronounce.
Oh, I think one would be a really successful show.
No, that's why I said really, only really one. Successful. Only one. Stop looking after one. That's
yeah, if you get to one, immediately stop, which will be roughly 8 seconds into the podcast, and I do apologize.
All right, so
do you want to begin with our friend James Monroe? I have fun ones.
Yeah.
I have a lot of fun ones here.
The only thing I know about Monroe is the Monroe document. I think that's like the only thing that I'm familiar with of his.
It was he written by him?
No. <That's right>. Yeah. He just signed it.
Yeah, he did. No, like seriously. But no, he was actually one of the best diplomats kind of ever. All right. Do you want me to read in Mr. Monroe's entrance?
Let's do it.
All right. Today our journey brings us to April 28th, 1758, in the quiet rural landscape of Westmoreland County, Virginia. The birthplace of James Monroe, a figure whose life and legacy significantly impacted the trajectory of American history. James Monroe, America's fifth president, often finds himself quietly nestled between the intellectual legacies of Jefferson and Madison in the vigorous and contentious election and diplomatic efforts of John Quincy Adams, who succeeded him. Though Adams is frequently credited with shaping America's foreign policy in the early 19th century, it was Monroe who first firmly set the nation's compass with clarity and vision, laying the cornerstone for America's global posture for generations to follow, even to this very day. Monroe entered the presidency in 1817, inheriting a nation emerging confidently from the shadows of the War of 1812. His tenure, famously labeled the Era of Good Feelings, represented a unique moment of national unity, characterized by political harmony, westward expansion, and growing economic optimism. Yet beneath the surface calm, Monroe navigated the complexities of a rapidly changing nation, confronting fierce debates over slavery, territorial expansion, and economic policy. Challenges that would soon test the bonds of American unity. Perhaps most enduring was Monroe's contribution to American foreign policy, notably through the Monroe Doctrine of 1823. Often associated with Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, this doctrine declared the United States would stand apart from European conflicts and colonialization efforts, forever changing America's place on the global stage. Yet behind the doctrine was Monroe himself, a president whose measured statesmanship and resolute vision continue to define America's diplomatic identity, and as mentioned earlier, continues to define it to this day. Who then was James Monroe, beyond the doctrine, beyond the presidency, and beyond the historic era he defined?
So, you said the era of good feelings. Are we past the founding fathers then? Do we have to get some new music and change up the themes?
So, controversially. So, James Monroe is definitely a founding father. Definitely a founding father. Mm-hmm. He was 17 during the American Revolution. We're going to get some cool stuff about him. His whole life before his presidency is going to take a couple episodes. So, what I'm hoping to do today, Kyle, if it's okay with you, is do from his birth to him going into the presidency. And it's a cool time.
Okay.
So, yes, James Monroe is definitely considered a founding father. After this, it gets a little complicated. Is John Quincy Adams considered a founding father?
Not when he's a baby to one of the founding fathers, right?
Yeah, so that
should be the next gen, right? Yeah.
But he also served as a translator and diplomat during the negotiations during the American Revolution.
Right.
So when he accompanied his father over to Europe, and he's fluent in seven languages, and there are a lot of historians who consider him to be the last founding father, which is very bizarre because his dad was definitely...
Well, his dad's a founding grandfather then, in that case.
Yeah, I mean, his father was on the Committee of Five. His father wrote, like, literally, like, every prominent document. But don't forget, many of the founding fathers didn't have kids. George Washington and Jefferson both had children that weren't involved. Madison didn't have a child. He had a stepson, the alcoholic gambler who constantly got him in trouble.
Yeah, we learned a bit about that.
Monroe was 17 when the American Revolution started. So the only guy who actually had like a kid who was engaged in any of this was Adams, and Adams was a lot older than the founding fathers. He was probably closer. You know, he was young, but he was probably closer to a Franklin than he was a Monroe.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like Monroe was more like a Hamilton then.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, have you heard of the Reynolds affair?
No.
Oh, we're going to have some fun about this. It involves duels and adultery, which is most of Alexander Hamilton's life. I just realized that.
I mean, he was a smuggler, wasn't he? A privateer, which is basically a pirate.
He was a privateer, Kyle. That is far more respectable. It's like a pharmacist versus a drug dealer.
Right. One is sponsored by a state.
What's the old definition? What's the definition of government? Whoever has a monopoly on violence?
Yeah.
The monopoly on the drug trade, I guess.
Right.
So, Kyle, as you know, or as the audience does know this, I go through great pains to not let Kyle find out anything about these presidents as we go into them. And I feel like Monroe's an interesting opportunity. I feel like you hinted at it a little bit with Madison, where Madison is where, you know, people like don't really, he's not like pop culture, like people don't know that much about him. And the only reason Kyle knows so much about John Adams is my constant harassment of him about John Adams.
Well, also all the landmarks and things that we've seen, trips that we've had to Quincy. We've spent a lot of time in their house.
Yeah. That's such a weird way to work.
Right,
that.
Isn't it?
So, Monroe, I think, is that first founding father, absolutely, who became president, who people don't really know that much about.
Right.
He's an absolute boss, aside from, you know, owning people. I think we all have to qualify everything besides the Adamses when we talk about here, is that these are slaveholders, so we don't want to, you know, act like they were perfectly indelible. But I think one of the important things when you measure history is you accept these are humans and they're going to do good things and horrible things and do great things and bad things.
Or they're going to be the Adams, and we just look forward to when we get to talk about them.
Yes, but they were also hated in their time. So just remember that. Everybody you hate right. now in yeah. the future could be the good guy.
Wait.
hold on a minute. I don't like that feeling. Kyle, my dear friend, I'm going to be, I try to be as honest with you as humanly possible. I was shocked to learn something during this.
Yeah.
I knew a lot about, obviously, because of Secretary of State and because of Thomas Jefferson. I already knew a lot about the James Madison episode.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to lie. We had a lot of research done for James Monroe. We knew a lot about him. What I did know, let me ask you a question. What do you think, okay. What do you think James Monroe looked like?
The guy behind me?
Yeah.
Like that?
Yeah. That's what you think he looks like. Give me his stats. This is the NFL Combine. What do you think he looks like?
Okay. Wasn't he like the same size as the other one that we just did? The short guy?
Madison?
Madison? Wasn't he like around the same size? Like 5'2"?
So that's what I thought. He's described as being 6 foot in an absolute unit.
Really?
Like, he's described, I'm like, wasn't he slightly taller than Madison?
Like a brick outhouse?
Really? Yes, dude. He really? Was just, like, like, to the point where, like, Washington, who's a big dude, commented, I'm like, oh, that dude's, like, I mean, again, he was shorter than Washington, but apparently he was just bulky and just, like, jacked.
You ever meet those guys? Like, I went to school with a guy like that. He was 14, and at 14, he could arm wrestle every 26-year-old adult around us and slam them on the table. It was insane.
Well, I won't shout him out because he has a successful law practice, but one of my very good friends was an offensive tackle when I was at WVU. Oh, I'm not wearing any WVU merch.
Oh, no,
I'm wearing WVU.
Oh, you,
I'm wearing WVU socks.
Okay,
wearing WVU socks. I don't want to date the episode, but the women are playing are playing right now. So if you hear my wife cheering in the background, it's because they're doing well. So he was an offensive lineman, and one of the funny things is that him and I are about the same height, but he's like 125 pounds more of muscle than I was at the time, and I was working all the time. I was in good shape. But what freaks me out is how fast they are. Like, you do cardio, and you're like, why are you faster than, like, anybody else I've met? Like, you're both a unit, and you move, like, he's a black bear. He's the only person I would take in a fight against a black bear. I'd be like, you know what? He would win.
Except I wouldn't want that guy with me, because I don't want anyone faster than me confronting a bear.
Oh, that's a good point. No, I think he would put it down. I think he would. He'd be like, "Don't worry, Eric. You can run away. I'm going to wrestle this bear into submission."
Yeah. See, but do you want to take that chance, or would you rather have Stephen Hawking with you? Just saying.
No, I get what you're saying. Yeah. I'm with you on it. You don't have to be the fastest. You just have to. You don't have to outrun the bear. You have to outrun your friends, unless you bring a friend who can wrestle a bear.
Right.
But yeah, just unit. He was just described as this like absolute tank of a man. And I love that. I love that we've rewritten history because he was supposed to be, he's brilliant, scholarly, hyper intelligent. From a very young age, he was identified as like incredibly sharp.
So at what point did that switch? Because I think you did say something about that when we were talking about Madison, about him being similar in stature.
Yeah. So everybody, very, very funny. So Madison and Monroe are like tied together really close. That's not just me saying that. Like, that's a pretty common historical trend.
Same initials.
Yeah. Same. They came from the same area. Westmoreland is also where Washington came from. Madison was incredibly more wealthy than Monroe. Monroe was, like, Madison. You had, like, the Martha Washingtons and the Jeffersons. And then there was a gap, and there was the Madisons. And the Madisons were, like, successful. I don't want to call them gentry, but, like, because I don't know if gentry would be the proper term for that time, but essentially gentry. Mm-hmm. Monroe's family was just mid-gentry. Like, they were just, like, enough money to own land, and they could afford slaves. Pretty much it. And then Monroe's dad died when he was 16.
So they're more like the guy who's blue-collar, but he's also, like, got some money socked away, and he's got a couple rentals, and he's doing okay for himself.
Yeah. If you're from Boston, it's like that dude who worked for like 103 and then inherited like two triple deckers in Southie, and now he has to cape him out of the vineyard. Everything I just said there may have sounded gibberish to everybody else besides the people listening in Boston. But yeah, no, I know that guy, Tony. Tony, you're talking about Tony.
Sounded like you're talking about inheriting some buses or something.
It is amazing that like people inherited like triple deckers that like people bought for like $14,000 and now they rent for like $4,500 a floor.
Wait, that's a real okay. All
yep.
right.
Yeah, no, dude. Yeah. Abigail Adams, hugely correct on land speculation in Greater Boston. Just call of the cent. That will go down as the best prediction throughout this entire series. We will record 400 episodes and nothing will be better than Abigail's being like, people are gonna want to live here. People who are going to buy land.
Right.
So to jump in, I know we covered a little bit of entrance. So to jump into James Monroe. So as I said, he's born April 28th, 1758. So about a month from when we're recording this, give or take. So this is where he was born in the same area of George Washington. This area is kind of very prominent among that like lower gentry to pure upper class. His father, Spencer Monroe, he was a moderate, like we mentioned earlier, he's a moderate successful planter and carpenter. Now, it's interesting here, whenever you hear and something else,
yeah,
that usually is a good sign when you read historical texts that they were at best mid, I'm going to keep using the word gentry because I'm tired of redefining that word every time, mid-gentry. And his mother
basically saying that they couldn't survive off of one job. They had to have a couple of gigs, right?
Yes.
Like John Adams being a shoemaker and a lawyer. Like, couldn't survive on one or the other is what it sounds like.
Yeah, and I think that plays very well into your example, Kyle. It's like, oh, hey, he had this property, but he was also had to work as a carpenter. His mother, Elizabeth, she was from a very well-established Jones family. They weren't like these wealthy aristocrats, but they were still prominent enough in their local community. It was actually when James Monroe's father died. When James, like I mentioned earlier, James is like 16, 17. It's, it's like we don't, again, back then, you're not like super sure when something happened, but we know he's like mid-ish to late-ish teens. Definitely way too young to have your father die.
It seems to be a recurring theme.
Yep, yeah, it definitely is. It's just pretty much just John Adams at this point, whose dad didn't die super young, and then the next president, John Quincy Adams, also didn't have that happen. But then I think we go back to a pretty long slew of that. What's funny is kind of, when you're super wealthy, like when Madison's father died and when Jefferson's father died, you can be so wealthy that you really just kind of, you're 17. Back then, 17's an adult. you're kind of like in receivership, to say that. Like, you inherit all the estates, but you may have like a guardian or a lawyer that's basically administrating it.
Like a regent, kind of?
That's perfect. I'm not even going to try and continue to qualify it. Just imagine that. But you're so wealthy that the interest spinning off of your estate is more than enough to pay like a full-time today CFA to manage your stuff. He wasn't. That's not how wealthy his family was. So they lost that income as a carpenter, and they still had the land. So Monroe actually ends up going under the receivership or guardianship of Joseph Jones, who is his maternal uncle, who was a very well-established lawyer and politician. Like, he was boys with everybody. Like, he is kind of a little bit Forrest Gumpy once you start diving into him. Like, I don't want to go like too much into him, but he was a member of the House of Burgess. He was a delegate to the Continental Congress. This is, I'm talking about Joseph Jones. Jefferson and Madison were bros, like straight up, very similar with how Madison was with Patrick Henry. Like, they loved each other. And so Monroe is, again, a lot younger. He's 1758, so think how young he is when this stuff's popping off. Madison was young. Like, Madison was already a young dude, and he was over a decade older than Monroe in a lot of this stuff. When he experienced his first rise to politics and stuff like that. But Monroe got introduced to this, like, these ideas of revolutionary political discourse before most of the men of his generation did. So as Monroe began to mature, he was like, oh, wow. Like, people looked to him. He already had these ideas. But what Jones's involvement and mentorship in Monroe's life, you know, it wasn't just access to education. He eventually did go to Williams & Mary. Hey, what a surprise. A politician from Virginia went to Williams & Mary.
Those loose ethics.
Yeah. Jones. That's still one of the best insults, ever. I know.
Every time I see our sister, I mention it.
Loose ethics. But also, he also channeled Monroe towards public service rather than just managing the plantation. And this is where we always have to explore this with these presidents, as we should. We'll be exploring this all the way up to Buchanan, the last president to hold slaves. This is where Monroe gets interesting. And I don't want to speak on behalf of Monroe's, nobody can do that. No historian, far more qualified than us, can do this. But this is where it's interesting with Monroe, because he was introduced to these ideas of democracy and liberty and you're the philosophes.
Yeah.
Before he ever got control of his plantation. And it would cause this rift in his psyche for his entire life. He didn't know what to do about slavery. And again, we'll go through his life and we'll talk about there's a couple of slave rebellions he actually put down. But he struggles with this concept for the rest of his life, where he intrinsically, he's not a Jefferson. Jefferson knows slavery is wrong philosophically, but doesn't really act on it. And his actions,
certainly don't look like he really thinks. He's not above taking advantage of the perks of.
Yeah. If anybody's ever listened to William Spaniel, William's the political philosopher and political scientist. So what does he always say? Watch what leaders do, not what they say.
Right.
That's Jefferson. And then you had Madison, who, Madison's life was very bizarre because Madison was incredibly sickly his whole life. So he, not that forgives anything, but he was never in a position to free his slaves. I mean, not that that justifies having them, but if you're putting yourself in Madison's shoes at that time, he was basically, I think, scared that, I can't work, that's how you make money, all this stuff, that he rationalized his view of slavery relative to his position. So I think you have Jefferson, who's philosophically against slavery. You have Madison, who's in practice philosophically against slavery, but in practice, has a hard time. He's a rationalist slaveholder. Where Monroe is this, you see this progress, by the way. You do see this progress over the Founding Fathers until they radicalize, until you start seeing Founding Fathers who become not emancipationists. So you have abolitionists and you have emancipationists. Mm-hmm. Abolitionists are like free slaves today. Emancipationists are like, let's free slaves over time. And this is going to shock a lot of people, but the United States was an emancipationist nation up until it had to be an abolitionist nation. Lincoln very famously said, if If I could save the Union by freeing all the slaves, I would. If I could save the Union by keeping all the slaves, I would. If I could save the Union by freeing half and keeping half enslaved, I would. And I think it's important as we do this dialogue in this dance with more and more of the Founding Fathers, we need to talk about the fact that the Founding Fathers were, large part, philosophically anti-slavery. But it never translated to action. Outside of the Adamses, they all owned slaves.
I think we need to hammer that point as many times as you can, though, because, I mean, you can look at it through their lens all you want, but the fact of the matter still remains. They could have downsized. You don't need a plantation.
Yes.
You could have sold that off, freed your slaves, and then accepted a lower status or a lower place to live and probably been fine and never had to work anyway.
Yeah, I mean, if they didn't, I know we can't swear, but absolutely pee through money. That was the problem.
Is
that you didn't have Abby at home being like, hey, John, stop peeing through money. And John be like, I don't want to pee through money. I just want to, like, walk around with my court, which were the animals he took care of after he left presidency. Again, the Adamses stand up so well to history. It is absurd. It is just absurd. I will argue that to the death. But it's funny to see this progression, and you expect the slave owners who were presidents to become softer over time up until Lincoln. No, the complete opposite. They become more radicalized and more factionalized. They become not emancipationists. That's why you have the end of the slave trade in 1808. There's evidence of this. This is like, theory. Presidents getting elected are advocating for the expansion of slavery out west, or presidents advocating, against the Dred Scott. Well, I was going to say against the Dred Scott decision, but the Dred Scott decision was in favor of slavery, so I guess advocating against Dred Scott. So we got to take the Founding Fathers' view on slavery and the subsequent presidents down the road and understand that they're actually getting more intense over time. So if it sounds like we're going to be doing kind of like a roller coaster of people who just didn't really view it philosophically to people who, as emancipationists, and how do you emancipate the slave populations? We're going to the other extreme where people start talking about never emancipating. And that's why the Civil War is going to happen. It's not, like, I know as an economist I shouldn't say this, but it's not about the economy. It's not about any of this. Like, it's not state rights. Okay. The Civil War is just fought over slavery, and it was eventually going to happen. And I think it's important, Kyle, that we see that as we talk about these people. We're talking about history. There's no, we can't hide the storyline.
Right.
But Madison, it is very interesting. Monroe is very interesting because he knows it's wrong. He talks about it being wrong, and he's trying to figure out a way. But he also thinks, because he saw so many slave rebellions while he was in office, and that he doesn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
He's beyond the theory of Jefferson saying, oh, it's a wolf by the ears. You don't know if it's going to leave or attack you. To him, he knows the wolf's going to attack him. And that brings me to a very easy, probably now easy trivia question. There are two presidents the capitals of countries are named after. What two presidents are they?
Washington, probably.
Washington, yes. The Washington of the United States.
Yeah. Mexico?
No. That'd be awesome if we took over Mexico and named after somebody. Liberia. No,
Mexico City. Yeah, that makes no sense. Liberia, really?
It's Monroeville.
Wait, wasn't... Hang on, wasn't Liberia the one that you said that they founded to try to send all the slaves back to?
Yep.
To free them? Was that Madison's plan?
It wasn't his plan. It was an idea people had, been floating out there for a while. And then there was a rebellion. Specifically, it was Gabriel's rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of wild. So it was run by this guy, Gabriel Prosser. He was an enslaved blacksmith who was owned by this guy, Thomas Prosser, in Hinterrock County, Virginia. And this is where we have to get a little in the specifics of slavery at this time. Is you had two types of slavery. You had task slavery and you had chain slavery. Chain slavery is what it sounds like, where you had, human beings.
Work until they die because it's cheaper to replace them.
Yeah, tied together in a chain.
Yeah.
Then you had tax slavery, which is what was practiced in the United States, and that was this concept of these people had a list of chores to do, or work assignments. I actually think they call them, I'm not joking, like there are primary sources that use the term chore. Like I wasn't meaning that like softening it. I mean like that's like actually you can find the terminology used. But they had a list of work to do, and once they completed it, they could grow their own garden or they could engage in trades. Well,
now I would like to point out too that most of this rule or form of slavery was for usually like white people, wasn't it?
No. This was chattel slavery.
Right, but these are the rules that were adopted from the way that it was treated, indentured servitude or whatever, in England and Europe and those places, right?
Yeah, that was largely what influenced in the United States. Then you have like Barbados.
What I'm guessing is, once we started importing slaves from Africa, we probably decided that they don't deserve to be treated like humans. It was kind of the mentality that seems to have shifted over time.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you're training people, like, I mean, it's like commodities. Right. The United States never widely adopted, chained slavery. That's why one of the most disturbing statistics you'll ever see in your life is Barbados in the United States. Barbados, which is like, I think I looked it up, is like smaller than Maine, imported the same amount of slaves as all of the United States throughout the slave trade.
Wow.
Wow. That's the difference between chain slavery and task slavery. But a lot of times these people were basically viewed as like, oh, I don't have to grow more food. I can grow this cash crop if this guy's also working on his garden. And that was a big reason. It's not like the slave owners were doing this to be benevolent. Was there some paternalism here? Absolutely. I mean, that's a hallmark of U.S. slave history is paternalism.
Yes.
But is that the main, are these people doing this to be benevolent? Absolutely not. They own other people. I hate when people are like, yeah, but they treated them well. It's like, that's an insane.
Does not matter.
insane thing to say. Gabriel was a very talented blacksmith. Like, if you see, it's funny, like we look at history being very, very flat. And if you actually try and, sometimes when it comes to events like this, I'll like map out a timeline to help my head think a little better on it. He was like well known for being just like one of the best blacksmiths in his area. And again, he's in a very prominent area of the country. But because he had this trade, he had, he can go around. He had what was sometimes described as like an unusual freedom of movement, highly literate and very political. He was a very, very, he had educated himself both in, his trade and in what's going on at the time. And he described himself as deeply influenced by the American and French Revolution. And he believed that, I'm going to say something a little ironic given where he is in the country and who said it, but believing that enslaved people had the right to liberty or death.
Liberty or death.
By somebody I already mentioned today, Patrick Henry's famous quote. Patrick Henry, who is probably, I think we did a short on Patrick Henry.
I mean, I think everyone has the choice between liberty and death, pretty much, right?
Yeah, in labor economics, that's why we say labor is always privately owned, because you can't force somebody, you can't go inside somebody's body and force them to work. So that's why socialism fails in the long run.
Neuralink's working on that.
So Gabriel, with his also very biblical name, Brother Solomon, and another enslaved man named Martin, they planned to capture, they planned to take over Richmond and capture James Monroe, who's the governor of Virginia at the time. This is 1800. And negotiate his freedom for the enslaved Virginians. So basically it was like step one, they were going to march into Richmond with like hundreds of armed slaves. They're going to take Monroe as hostage. They never planned to hurt him, by the way. Yeah. Like there was like, they're very open about like, no, they just was like, that's what they're going to do.
Please let us go. Please. Yeah. And somebody, anybody.
Kyle, I'm suspicious that you hacked my computer and read my next part because what you said earlier.
Oh no, what's that?
They were going to recruit poor white indentured servants and laborers to help them take on the plantation owners. And then they were going to await reinforcement from sympathetic groups. And it's funny, there was the Quakers, the Methodists, and the French, who were all like real anti-slavery, which is super ironic for this time for the French, like comically ironic as they bludgeon Haiti to oblivion. God, they are the most... Everybody knows my opinion on France at this point, so I don't need to go on, but just the most oh my God, just hypocrisy of France for the last thousand years.
Congo? Was Congo the one to look at?
That was the Belgium. It was Central African Republic, just north of the Congo. No, the Belgians also have pieces of absolute garbage during that time period.
No, there was the French one where I think they, what were they, like charging them, like interest on... the currency reserves that they held for them.
Oh, no, that's still going on. Yes, yeah, the Trafficking Frank. No, that's still happening. And we're supposed to, you know, take these people for their morality. but then two other good groups, the Quakers and the Methodists, they have always been anti-slavery. Like, literally since they were founded. I believe John Wesley, one of his big things when he was founded was like, not to dive too much history at the Methodist Church, but so they were founded by John Wesley. And they are very famously, they didn't name themselves. They just had a very methodical view of how to practice. They believed in, like, small groups and stuff like that. And people are like, oh, these people with all their methods. Look at these Methodists. I love that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So they, you know, it's funny because they were formed, like, in opposition to this thing called Calvinism, this idea of the elect, this idea that, like, you can do whatever you want. If you're getting to heaven, you're getting to heaven. But Calvinism is kind of this, like, quasi-rejection of Anglicanism. So Methodists are Anglicans,
was Calvinism the one that kind of like got rid of all the holidays because no work was getting done because like every other day was a holiday?
I could see them doing that. The Romans also had to do that after they conquered so many people. so it seems to be an in-game solution to a lot of stuff,
right?
But the Methodists sometimes and it depends. I mean, I don't. It very much. This is a very broad thing, but there are some philosophers who say like Methodists would consider themselves non-papal Catholics, and there is writings by the Catholic Church had banned slavery for hundreds and hundreds of years at this point, and John Wesley was like wicked anti-slavery, and so naturally like Methodism when they came over here became very anti-slavery, and Methodism is still the largest practiced religion in these areas. It's usually Methodism and Catholicism in these two areas. So they were like, oh, these guys are going to join us, they're going to like us. You know, by, you know, August 30th, falling apart because they're getting ready to go on the attack. There's this massive thunderstorm. It delayed everything. And these two enslaved people just decide to rat out everybody.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Man.
So, yeah. Monroe ends up capturing, ends up calling up the Virginia militia. It prevents the uprising. They arrest him and dozens of other suspects. Gabriel refused to tell anybody about anything else. He and the 25 other people they captured were executed by October. So it was only about a month later, a month and a half later, they were executed. And that led to, you know, this recourse among Virginia legislators. And don't forget, Monroe was the governor at the time. Harsher slave laws, and it stopped restrictive movements on slaves. It stopped literacy among enslaved people. And this is but something very interesting. They also banned the importation of slaves from other states and from outside the country. And it wouldn't be until 1808 that the slave trade was fully banned.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. And this is where Jefferson...
Wait, So they put in a bunch of restrictions to make it worse to be a slave, but then they also said don't bring any more.
Yeah.
Huh. Was that like Monroe's way of, yes, of getting a little something for having to? I can't imagine he wanted to execute 25 men.
I don't. You know, it's funny reading primary sources on here. Monroe never injected himself, and if you're a politician that really believes in this is gravy to you. You would absolutely be the first guy. But we need to follow through the most severe punishment. But he never seems to have. Again, I could have missed that as a source, but I feel like that would have been a top tier.
Doesn't
that
sound
popped
like,
up, like right.
He tried to save them either, though.
No, and that ambivalent attitude is largely Monroe when it comes to slavery. So this is where Jefferson really becomes hyper-cautious about emancipating his slaves. But also, I hate when historians write that, but he was never going to emancipate. If you're not freeing your own children, you are not, in fairness to Jefferson.
You have one of your children teach another child. No.
Yeah, because you like mac and cheese.
Yeah.
But Mr. Gabriel, I'm not going to use literally his slave last name because that's insane that that's even how he's written about, but Mr. Gabriel actually was pardoned in 2002 by the state of Virginia and relabeled as a freedom fighter rather than a criminal.
That only took 200 years. It's good that they
got
it fixed. I like that
the history. But this event and why I bring it up is really why Monroe became paranoid about freeing slaves, but still always struggled with that. He never rejected in any of his writing the idea that this is where it gets almostly. I'm going to get a little opinion in here. It gets really interesting with Monroe because Monroe never seems to ever describe or view slaves as inferior humans which is kind of all a different type of screwed up. He views it as a system. Like,
yeah, oh, these people. Well, as you said, it's almost worse. Yeah, if you're, it's almost worse if you believe that they're equal, and yet you still believe that you have the right to own them.
Yes, I do think that's very much like it. And so he decides to. This is where the idea of Liberia really starts to get solidified with Monroe. He really starts to kind of sit back and go, maybe it's better if we separate. Maybe if it's better if we, you know, allow the slaves to form their own country. He starts talking about, he gives a speech in 1817. I know we're getting a little into his presidency, but I think all this stuff's really important to understanding how Monroe is as a person. It's because Monroe never actually wrote any treaties or anything on slavery. But he expressed, you know, in letters, extreme discomfort. He called slavery the great evil. But he insisted that if slaves were freed within the United States, it would cause social chaos. He worried about what he described as a large free black population would do to the stability of Southern society. And then he became a huge supporter of colonialization. He said, after this, he helped establish the American Colonialization Society in 1816, with Henry Clay and this other guy, Bushrod, which is an awesome name, Bushrod Washington, which is George Washington's nephew. Dude, by the way, like, great name, but like very tentative relationship to old G-Dub. And in 1821, he supported the colonization of freed African Americans in the capital. So, Monrovia was named after him.
Can you clarify a little bit? He was afraid of what would happen if he'd freed the slaves, if there was a large population of black. There's a large black population in the South. What was he afraid of?
The unknown. This is where it gets a little.
The reason why I bring that up is because if he's obviously not viewing them as American at that point. Then if there's
no, he doesn't. That's not viewing them as.
That's not viewing them on the same plane. That the same. I would argue that as a point against that. But that's being, I guess, nitpicky.
No, I do agree. I think I don't think they viewed them as Americans. I 100% agree with that. This is very interesting because when you read historians and you read different books, what's funny is that if you actually read the papers historians write, they beautifully craft the Gabriel Rebellions and something called the Denmark Vesey slave uprising in South Carolina. They beautifully craft that as the beginning and end. So you have the 1800 rebellion of what we just described. You then have James Monroe is the governor. He puts down this plot, all this stuff. And he was already kind of saying, like, okay, I view these as people. They need to have their own place. You know, he views them more as they can't live in our society. You know, let's go form their own country and move it over here, to the point where he helps establish the American Colonialization Society, which is obviously, you know, that, well, you don't have to agree with it, but he clearly believed in that. But then he signs into law in 1820 banning the slave trade in U.S. territories. So that's different, because you had 1808 that banned the slave trades into the U.S. And now he's banning it in U.S. territories.
Yeah. So like South Carolina can't sell to Virginia anymore, or vice versa.
Yes. And it was even more prominent in the federally administered territories in the West, which would be like the Midwest now. 1821 is when Liberia was created. So timeline-wise, and this is why, if you can find good historians, they're worth their weight in gold. Because instead of just trying to teach this like something you just read in a quick textbook line, like, oh, several slave rebellions shifted Monroe's view on Liberia. Like, no. Then in 1822, you had the Denmark Vesey slave uprising, which was this guy named Denmark Vesey, which is fire name. fire names. Yeah, so he was born in 1767, where he was taken from the Caribbean. So he was Caribbean to Charleston, South Carolina. He won a lottery in 1799 and purchased his freedom, but was unable to buy his wife and children's freedom. I mean, Okay, so you got everybody's probably on this dude's side immediately. I got two sentences into this, and you're already like, okay, whatever this dude does next, you're now deciding, is he a hero or an anti-hero? He's already on the correct side of history. We're just trying to figure out, is he Batman or is he Superman? We don't know which one he is yet.
He's more Tony Stark.
A little Tony Stark, yeah. So he's this incredibly religious man. Like incredibly religious man. And he was a member of Charleston's Black Methodist Church, where he was a great orator. He's a great speaker. So he's a very religious, great orator. And he starts secret recruiting enslaved and freed black men for years. This is not something that... This is not the Gabriel Rebellion, which was planned over a couple months. This is years and years. Mm-hmm. But his plan involved killing white slave owners and seizing their weapons, burning Charleston to the ground, and then escaping to Haiti, as we mentioned earlier, it recently won its independence through a successful slave revolt. And he attracted thousands of people.
Shocking, yeah.
Yeah, so again, you can decide if he's Batman or Superman. That is your option on what type of history he is. He's certainly in the John Brown family of we want the end of slavery and we want it now. And we're willing to fight about it. It's just like with Gabriel, two enslaved men linked the plan to their masters because they were fearing repercussions. Charleston authorities quickly arrest Vesey and his co-conspirators. More than 130 black men were arrested and 35 were executed, including Vesey himself. Here's where it gets even darker. The city then destroyed Charleston's African Methodist Episcopal Church, where much of the rebellion was planned. And here's where Monroe, you see the switch. This is where the snap occurs with Monroe, where he becomes fully committed to the idea of Liberia. Monroe supported South Carolina's crackdown. Remember, he was president at this time. The rebellion hardened attitudes in the South towards slavery. Many states passed harsher laws restricting free black people, banning black-led churches and independent black organizations, and it just increased general paranoia. You're going to hear the word paranoia about slavery is going to keep popping up on here.
Shocking,
who
huh?
Who would have guessed? Right. Who would have guessed that the people you're currently
holding 30 people on a plantation and one person running it, and you wonder what's going to happen if these guys all get together and realize that they can overpower you.
Yes, and you treat them like absolute garbage because they're humans. Yeah, it is, you know, it is funny, because you do have him banning slave trade, and so slaves were still allowed to be traded inside of states, but that became more of a state issue. I don't want to say like, oh, it's a state issue. No, I mean like it literally was legislated by the state. But this is where Monroe, again, we're going to constantly be doing that awkward flip where the big reason he bans the slave trade in the United States is because he feared Western territories could become slave trading hubs.
It maybe even just to try to limit the growth of it too? Because you know that there's this path that you're heading down that's going to lead to conflict. It gets inevitable at this point, the trajectory that we're on. Maybe by restricting the influx of it, you can maybe try to keep it from growing too much more, limiting the damage of that conflict.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and Kyle, you hit it again. I feel like you hacked my. Either you have like the great, you were in the top 1% of 1% of knowledge on James Monroe's presidency in life, and don't know it. But like, dude, what about I have my notes because I'm not a schmuck. I do try and prepare for these things. I do like reading about this stuff. My next point. I wish I could share my screen with you right now. My next point is the Missouri Compromise of 1820.
That's right.
So, he was a supporter of this, and that's why Massachusetts lost Maine, RIP, because Missouri joined the Union as a slave state, and then
that was Maine all about keeping the balance, state. Wasn't it? Yeah, because they needed to keep the balance of
He also signed banning slavery north of the 36-30 latitude line.
Is that the one that had the 3/5 compromise in it too, or is that a different one?
No, that's the Great Compromise of the Constitution.
I think we already covered that one, actually, didn't we?
Yes, yeah. I think there's probably a lot of comments. We went off the rails a little bit on that got worked out of the final script, but we were very heated about the simultaneous. They're not people, but we want the to count so we can win elections, and that's not going to come back and bite us in the butt with the next election of John Quincy Adams. It's not like he's going to Jackson's entire argument is going to be based on owning people that he doesn't think are people, and them somehow not being able to vote, but their votes count. That's not going to have any bad side effects.
Well, you mentioned he was a little bit involved in the Revolutionary War. Like, was there anything notable there that?
My dear friend. I think you beat me. I think this is a good. You've been on fire today. For us recording this off our normal time and later at night, you're in rare form right now.
It's because I'm in a fever dream.
Why don't we Ooh. End this beautiful discussion? What we'll do is we'll, if it's okay with you, dear host, talk about one of my favorite random facts. There's only two presidents to ever have been shot in combat. Can you name them?
Ooh. Okay. Presidents shot in combat.
And shot in combat.
In combat. So yes. Teddy Roosevelt doesn't count because he was just giving a speech.
Nope.
But was he shot in any? How about Eisenhower? Was he ever
shot? Not Eisenhower.
No? Okay.
I have a secondary trivia after this that I thought was cool.
Did he serve in the military? I'm guessing that.
Yeah. So he was shot in military combat.
Okay. Warren G. Levin.
Most corrupt president. Because Eric had to write a paper on him in fifth grade. So thank you, Mrs. Edstrom. I will always remember this dude.
Wait. Herbert Hoover. No. Sorry. David Rice Atchison.
Did you say Herbert Hoover as an unknown president? There's a damn named after him.
I know. I just typed it into Google. That was the first thing that spot out.
He started the Easter egg roll on the White House lawn and electrified the White House.
Okay, who was that?
Rutherford B. Hayes.
Okay, so Rutherford B. Hayes is one. Who was the other one?
And the other is James Monroe. Shot in the chest. He's a beast and took a round.
What kind of gun?
A musket.
Like, oh, my God.
Fashion.
Like half-inch rounds?
Yeah, so... Oh, and where was he shot? Oh, Kyle, I'm so happy you asked that question. You know the famous painting of George Washington crossing the Delaware?
Yeah.
James Monroe's on that painting. He lands with the boarding party and is shot... What he shot in the shoulder, chest shoulder area, severs an artery and almost bleeds to death on the, after crossing the Delaware. There's a guy, Dr. Riker, managed to save him, but the bullet scar he carried for like his entire life, he just a massive bullet scar. Huh. Guys,
did the being hypothermic from the river crossing maybe save his life?
Probably.
If it severed an artery, I mean.
They have, like, no idea how this dude survived, by the way. Like, they're like, dude, you got shot in the chest in the middle of a battle. AIDS, like, you're going to get infected. He was the first president ever to be injured in combat.
But he wasn't president at the time.
No, just anybody who was injured. He's the first to be injured in combat.
You tricked me with that.
Yeah. So, I don't want to get gross, but John Riker had to reach into the wound and pinch the artery.
Right.
He was going to bleed to death. And because of that, they were never able to actually remove the musket ball.
Huh.
Yeah, so everything cool you think about Andrew Jackson is actually James Monroe. Andrew Jackson's like, oh, I got assassination attempted, and I kept the bullets in my chest. No, James Monroe took a bullet fighting for this country. Yeah, so, you know, one of the things I always like to think of is them as people, right? And I think we did a lot of time here talking about, his military career, and you know, just to kind of wrap up a little bit of his military career, he was injured at the he had a pretty illustrious, you know, to be honest with you, revolutionary career, arguably the best besides Washington, I would say, of any of the founding fathers.
Really?
You know, he left college, he enrolled at William and Mary's, but in 1774, left in 1775, he joined the war effort. It's a funny thing, like everybody was like trying to be, all the other founding fathers were diplomatic, he was like, nah, give me a rifle. At 17 he leads the raid on the governor's palace in Williamsburg, seizes a bunch of weapons and patriots other stuff for the patriots, and people were like, oh, this dude's awesome. A little while later he joins the actual Continental Army instead of just just the irregular militias, becomes a second lieutenant in the 3rd Virginia Regiment under George, directly under George, General George Washington. Hey, very quickly, people are like, this kid knows what's up. You gotta imagine, he's 18, gets named a captain at this time in the Continental Congress.
Jeez.
Many young people here get named captain at this time period are in militias, which is the D-League, essentially, yeah. for the military. He's, I don't know if that was offensive. I don't think there's any, like...
I don't think there's anything, I mean, that's not inaccurate, yeah.
And I get very upset, just quick rant, when people equate militias to the National Guard. No, militias of the 1770s. National Guard is essentially like separate militaries we have that are state funded. They're not the same as a militia in 1775. That's not, no.
I put our National Guard up against most standing armies.
Yes, I mean, the 29th Division, like, very famously held back the Nazis during the Battle of the Bulge. They were...
You want to talk about people in Waco?
No.
That's a little bit different. That's a militia.
No. The guy who on the weekends is like able, like learning how to operate drones and Abram tanks is not the same as a 1775 militiaman. I'm sorry. That's right. Insane that people think. Still equate those two things. So he's involved in the Battle of Trenton, almost dies. And now you probably think that's the end of the war for him. No. Absolutely not. By 1777, he's back in. He fights at the Battle of Brandywine in Germantown in Monmouth. He was like distinguished for his bravery. He struggled to become a commissioned officer because at this point it's still very like aristocratic. He ends up like dipping out and is just like, I don't really want to do this. This is when the war is pretty much over. The battle, we haven't. The British haven't surrendered, but the war's essentially over. There's no mid-Atlantic fighting going on right now. So he's like, I get it. You're not going to make me an officer. I'll leave. But he does eventually become an aide to General William Alexander, but it remains close to George Washington, though they never really like had like a mentor-protege relationship. And yeah, he leads the army in 1780 after they pretty much told him he's not going to get commissioned. Hamilton, they have a weird, and we'll get into that next episode. Hamilton and him start seeding what we'll talk about next episode. But yeah, he ends up leaving and going to studying law under Jefferson and, you know, shifting into politics. But I think one of the, you know, kind of last things to bring up is that, again, we like to humanize these people. And I think it's cool to talk about, like, no, James Monroe isn't this, like, James Madison looking guy. He's a unit. He would still, today, James Monroe would beat the crap out of you. He would. He's a war hero with a musket in his shoulder who died, posing for a famous painting across in the Delaware. Like, this guy is hellacious in his resume. But it's important to remember that he was still a brother. He had four siblings. We don't really know that much about his life. Elizabeth, Spencer, Andrew, and Joseph. Joseph later became a judge. That's all we really know about him. We don't really know that much about Spence Jr. Andrew is another one of his brothers who we don't really know that much about. But, these are people who were formed in formative in his life. He did have him and Elizabeth, who he was 27 and met Elizabeth at 17. We're going to talk a lot about Elizabeth. That's why I didn't bring her up in this episode, because Elizabeth... Good. Does some cool stuff during the French Revolution and is actually still the most popular first lady in France to this day because of her. Yes, and she's a tough lady. You're gonna like her a lot. Not as good as my girl Abby, but and Elizabeth have three kids. Eliza Hay. They have three kids. Only two survived to adulthood. It's the two daughters. Eliza Hay, as she becomes known. She ends up marrying this prominent Virginia lawyer and judge in 1808. She ends up having a daughter, and that's actually James Monroe's only grandchild. She was just like her father. She was considered sharp, assertive, stylish. But she was also like, she'd just get bored. Like, if she wasn't intellectually stimulated, she'd dip. His son, James Monroe, ends up passing away at 16. This is around 1800, so this is actually like right around the Gabriel Rebellion. Oof. He never, what's completely understandable for a parent. He writes that he never got over that, really got over it. A couple years later, they have their daughter Maria Gouverneur. She ends up marrying Monroe's secretary, who was also her first cousin. But 1800s, I don't know what to do about that.
They might not have known.
Yeah, but and the reason I bring this up is that
he's kin, but they's not blood. Sorry, just watch Bert Kreischer stand up.
job. But they have a couple interesting notes, which is that's the first wedding ever held at the White House is under James Monroe with his daughter.
Really?
His daughter. What's funny, his daughters never got along. And they actually had this, huge blow up after Monroe's death regarding his personal papers. They actually, because they can never figure this out, they actually just let his estate fall to crap. They never preserved anything. He has no descendants left today. So a lot of this primary, a lot of these sources I've talked about are actually pretty much secondary sources. There's a lot of direct stuff, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But in the day, going through all those sources, going through everything, I was very surprised. We were able to piece together, I think, one of the most complicated presidents leading up to his presidency when it comes to the topic of slavery, the topic of these ideals of the revolution. But I just got to say, I was not expecting to learn that James Monroe is just an absolute badass. He's just a war veteran. I mean, I don't know. You get shot in a severed artery in 1775 after your rich uncle sends you to an elite school that you could have just chilled out the entire time, but you're like, nah. And then you struggle with these ideas of liberty and freedom for your entire life. And, we're going to dive into it more in this episode. But if there's nothing to take away, you could beat James Monroe in a fight. That's what I learned today. Yeah. And so next week we're going to talk about, James Madison performing an audit and discovering a financial, a adulterous affair with Alexander Hamilton, how his wife saved one of the most prominent philosophers' wives from the guillotine. And I guess we'll also talk about Louisiana.
Okay. Well, I think that's probably a good place to call it for part one. So please join us next week as we start picking apart the policies that define Monroe's presidency. And while you're waiting, tell us what you think about Monroe. Are you enjoying learning about our fifth president, or should we have skipped right to John Quincy Adams? Leave us a comment. Email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com. Visit the website at buckstartsherepodcast.com to stay up to date. We will see you all next week.
Have a good one.
Produced by China Shop Productions.